right, recently you put out a music CD entitled Whistle Stop.
Yeah.
How long did that thing take to get made?
Oh, that was a long, long project. Started in June of 2004, finished it in November. So, and no, not working on it every day, but certainly working on it, you know, a few days a week. And it was hard work. 17 people played on that. 14 songs. That's a lot of songs. Just a lot of that was a real education. Starting from writing the songs right through to the end, to the CD release party, I had never been through something like that before, and that was a learning experience. That was I never would have guessed all that was involved when I started that project. And looking back on it, I'm not sure, had I known all that was involved, that I would have taken it on. Because it wasn't as though I was sitting around with nothing to do, needing to fill the time when I took on that project. But I'm glad I did it. I'm glad it's done. It's something I always wanted to do, and now I don't have that itch the way I did for so long.
Where did you get all the players, all the people that took part in it?
Well, it was hard. I mean, some I knew, and some were friends, fortunately, so they did favors for me. Some I had to actually beg, go on the air, please, will someone play guitar on this? That's how Paul Masich came along.
Okay.
Called old friends of my brother's, and then my producer, Jared Rush, called in some chips. He called in some favors from friends, and eventually we put it all together. And then some people just flat out had to be paid, professional musicians. I had to come up with the money. But fortunately, Mark Moeller was the catalyst. He was the one who agreed early on to fund the whole thing and make it happen. And without him, I wouldn't have done it because I didn't have that kind of money.
Right. You've mentioned before that he backed that project.
Yeah, he's given me money pretty much any time I've needed it.
Have you paid him off yet for the album?
I did. I paid him 4/5 of it, and then the last fifth he wouldn't take. He just wouldn't take the money, yeah.
Okay. But actually, this is... Whistle Stop was your second music offering, though, wasn't it? Didn't you record an album?
Well, I don't
years
count
ago?
That other one because it was just a cassette. And it was really, I thought, not very professional. I was, you know, it wasn't even done in stereo. It was me and Michael Lunan screwing around. I mean, Michael helped me out for free, okay, which was kind of him. But, you know, I don't think we put out anything that I'm very proud of.
What was that one? Was that just you and the piano, or was it?
No, it was Michael playing most of the instruments, maybe a couple other people. Actually, a couple people who were on the current CD. Chris Miller played on it, a little fiddle, an accordion, and Donna Dahl sang on that first recording as well. And she's on the CD, Whistle Stop. These are just people I knew. But it was, it's something I hope is in a landfill somewhere. I hope nobody out there has a copy of it.
How many copies
were made? Sort of like going back and reading high school poetry. It's real embarrassing.
How many copies were made of that?
Or
do you have any
idea? Maybe 500 of them. Maybe 400 of them.
Okay. Now that 6 months, it's been about half a year, or maybe 7 or 8 months have passed since the CD was officially released, the Whistle Stop one. And now that little bit of time has passed, how do you feel when you look back?
Well,
a little distance of time, how does it feel when you look back at what you've done?
Fortunately, when I play it now, I still like it. I'm worried that what will happen will be similar to what happened with that first attempt.
Right.
One day I'll put it on and go, oh, dear God, why didn't someone tell me? Why didn't someone tell me I was doing this poorly? Was everyone too afraid to hurt my feelings? Why didn't they say that this was as bad as it was? So I put it on recently to see if that was happening yet, and it wasn't. Every year or so, I'll play it again and wince just to see if it's still okay with me. That's all I care about is it still okay with me? Because I hate the fact that I can be such a lousy judge of what's good. The time is the great test, and it's so hard for me to enjoy things after a lot of time has gone by, and that worries me so much because I think my judgment then is real off. The only other thing that I can say has held up pretty much is this, the CD I put out here at KSTP, the Best of Mishki double CD, a lot of the material on that, I think, holds up years later. Not all of it, but a lot of it does. And I'm happy about that, because there was also a fear that, oh, I like this at the time, I find this pretty good now, but years from now, I could listen and say, oh, why didn't someone stop me? But so far, when I listen back to that, after all these years, I still think, yeah, I think I'd have picked those same cuts. And that's great that happens, because you don't want to be embarrassed by your own work, especially something that's now out and you can hold it a tangible item. That, I mean, if I do a bad show, I can always say to myself, well, it's gone. You know, no one's saving it. I don't have to listen to it again. No one else is going to listen to it again. And there's some comfort there. But you put out a CD or you write a book or something, it must hurt like hell when people, after a while, realize that wasn't that good after all.
Okay. Now, you seem to be a very musically inclined person, and if it ever came down to it and you felt you did have a real talent for music, would you ever prefer to go down the road of professional musician?
No.
Or rather remain at the helm of the Mishki broadcast?
No, I wouldn't want to do... What I see happen a lot with guys I know who play music for a living is the music all of a sudden quits being fun, and the music becomes work. And once it becomes work, a lot of the joy gets sort of squeezed out of it, and that's one of the saddest things to watch, because if there's anything in life that should bring joy to you, it's music. And when people have played long enough and been at it, trying to make a living long enough, and have that going through the motions look, and even that burned out quality, it's really hard for me to watch, and I've seen it in several musicians. So what I like about music is, you know, when the spirit moves you, you play, and when you feel like it, you sit at the piano, and when a song comes to you, even if it only comes to you once every 9 months, you jot it down. But you operate that way. You don't put pressure on yourself to make it a job, a 40-hour week working on music. That I couldn't do. That would drive me crazy. And the road, I think the older you get, life out in hotels and on the road, especially for guys with families, I think that's miserable for maintaining a decent family life, and I would never want to screw that up. So, nope, that'll never happen.
Okay. Couldn't you say, in terms of burnout, the same things would happen at times with the broadcast, too?
With one, there's one big difference. When I get up in the morning and that show is waiting, those 2 hours are waiting at 10 o'clock at night, and there's nothing there. It's 2 hours of dead air, and I'm going to fill it with something. There are absolutely no rules whatsoever. There is no format whatsoever. Anything can happen, including saying nothing for those 2 hours, which I've done.
Right.
It's a little different with music. In music, in general, you will play some instrument. You will sing a song. It's just the great thing about my show is if you tire of the show, you tire of life, because the show is just life. It's anything you can come up with in life, anything, anything at all. And so if you're tired of that, even a guy who paints for a living, sure, he can paint any picture he wants every day, but he's going to have to paint. I guess you could argue, I'm going to have to use some sound. I'm going to have to play with sound. But that is my only restriction. And even then, one time I didn't use any of my own sound. I didn't say a word. People called in. But so the freedom there, to burn out on that kind of freedom, I think, would be to burn out. If I'm burning out on that, I'm sort of burning out on life. There is no other job that I can do. If I burn out on this, I would burn out on any job. If I burn out on this, it means I don't want to work anywhere and do anything. I just want to sit in my backyard and feed squirrels. So that's the difference. That's the difference.
And I think you just defined the Mishki broadcast.
Yeah.
It's
whatever.
It's been hard to put your finger on, but it's...
Yeah, it's limited only by my imagination, only by my... it's limited by an inability I have to come up with more and different ideas for what to do with the show. I do get frustrated by the fact that I probably am not coming up with enough different things to do on the air. I think that there are thousands of things I'm not thinking about, I'm not thinking of, I'm not coming up with, that I could if I could just flip a switch in the brain or shift some chemical in the noggin and then more ideas would flow.
Drugs
would help, but then that, of course, has been proven in many quadrants to not actually be true.
Right.
What happens too often with drugs is you think you're more creative, but the people next to you who are sober and watching you just think you're a moron.
How about, have the Hubbards or managers ever tried to rein in the show in some way or say
never.
It should be done this
never.
Way? Do more of this?
Never.
More interviews?
And that is perhaps the most shocking statement I can make for this whole interview and the most surprising thing I can say. I don't think there's anything more stunning than to say after 14 years with the way I've done radio that I have never been directed once by my bosses ever on what to do with those 2 hours. That's what I will take to my grave as the most amazing part of my career, is how the Hubbards have operated with me.
So the question is, are they asleep at the wheel, or are they geniuses to let you do what you want?
I don't know. I would say
I think it's the latter.
I would say that their view of radio is you bring in someone you believe to be a talented talk host, you give them all the rope they want, and I've said it before, they give you that rope, and you either make a career out of it or hang yourself. And that's what people have done over the years here. They've either taken that rope and created a wonderful show, or they've taken that rope and they've tied it around their neck and killed off their career. Most of the people, if not all the people who have lost a job here, have lost a job because with that rope, they didn't create a great show.
So are you
and
saying
a
the
great
Hubbard
show is defined in this instance, and what I'm talking about, is defined as a show that attracts a great deal of interest by the people listening. I mean, that a lot of people get interested and listen in numbers that make it successful. I guess I shouldn't say great show, I should say successful show. They have been given that rope and have not been able to create a successful show.
Okay. So do the Hubbards?
I was just going to say, I don't think the Hubbards fire people who are succeeding.
All right. Do they give the same latitude to each?
I don't know.
Talk show host? You don't know?
I don't know.
Okay.
We're individuals. We're little islands here. And I don't know what's happening with the other shows. I don't know when people are being called in or when they're being telephoned at home or what. And we don't talk much to each other here, the various talk hosts. That's an unusual aspect of working here. You have to understand that if one show is wildly successful, it doesn't mean the rest of us are successful. So one show's success doesn't really trickle down to you necessarily. So everybody sort of just works on their own show, tries to keep their own career afloat, and doesn't really worry what the other shows are doing, because those shows have to worry about themselves. Everybody wants to, you know, try and hang in there. We see a lot of people get fired. I've watched 17 people, on-air people, get fired. It's
how many? 17?
Yeah, something like that, on-air people, yeah.
So do you ever have, does the company ever have get-togethers or any sort of Christmas party or something?
Well, they have a Christmas party every year. I don't go to that. I don't like large crowds, so I don't like to go to that.
Okay.
There isn't much getting together outside of that. They have a Christmas party, and they used to have something in the summer. They haven't in recent years, I don't think. Or they have, and I didn't hear about it. See, I'm at night. I don't walk the halls and see other coworkers and talk to people about what's going on. Maybe it's different during the day. Maybe the talk hosts crisscrossing visit with one another and with the salespeople and with the receptionist. I don't know how it goes, but I work at night, and there's no one in this building. So I feel like just a guy who's got a little hardware store down the street and shows up every night at 10 to work it and goes home at midnight. It doesn't feel like I'm working for a big company.
Okay. Now, when you released your CD, you had a CD release party, and you
uh-huh.
said that was something that you didn't want to do yourself but felt you had to because you learned that this was a way to make a heck of a lot of money quick to pay back Mark Moeller?
Yeah, I wasn't going to do it, and my producer convinced me that if you are in debt because of this and need to pay a guy back and aren't going to do a CD release party, then you are going to spend years getting this guy paid back. It's just, the sales are just going to trickle in. I mean, of course, you have to do a CD release party. He told me, what is the point of doing a CD if you aren't going to promote it? And since you don't have radio play with it, it won't be promoted that way. You got to do a CD release party. So I said, okay, I'll do one. And that was what was at O'Gara's on the 8th of December.
Now, I personally attended that CD release party, and the first thing that struck me walking in there was the crowd. I thought there was something else going on because there was this huge line when I came in the door, and I asked someone, what are you here for? And they said, well, the Mishki CD release party. And I asked some more people, what are you here for? The Mishki party. And there's this line that snaked all the way from the entrance to the garage, all the way through the bar, did a huge circle, and I believe ended up even going outside the door. And I found that amazing because I've been to other get-togethers you had years ago where there's usually 6 to 12 people.
Yeah.
And I had made arrangements to meet with other people at that CD release party that I'd only talked to over the internet, so I didn't know what they looked like. But I just said, oh, I'll see you at the release party. And I'm thinking it's going to be no big deal, no problem.
Right.
And I get in there, and it's wall-to-wall people. You can barely move. And
right.
I never did hook up with the people I wanted to that night, but I still had a great time because I talked with other people who were around me and were fans of the broadcast or were here to hear the music.
Yeah.
Did that surprise you, the amount of people that were at that?
It did in a way, and it didn't in a way. The difference between that CD release party and the other events that you used to attend was those other events would be just something I'd do on the show, you know, something I'd come up with or a listener would come up with, or we just kind of keep it on the show, just sort of just isolate it during the hours of the program and talk about it there. This thing became a station promotion. And so now you have the station getting behind it, and they're advertising it up and down during the day in all the shows. And, you know, the listenership during the day is pretty sizable. I mean, during Souchere, they're hitting so many people. If a fraction of those people want to attend, it's going to be a pretty good crowd. So, and they were promoting it, I think, almost too much. It was starting to get embarrassing. And so I saw that and thought, you know, and then I also think when it was known other people at the station were going to attend, other talk show hosts, then it became sort of the sense of it maybe being a whole KSTP type gathering, not just me and some of my listeners. So I did get the sense after seeing how big the promotion was that we were going to have something quite different from what I was used to in the past when I just say on the show, let's all go over to the Shantytown Grill.
Right.
But I didn't anticipate it. I didn't anticipate people not being able to get in. I certainly didn't anticipate a night where people were turned away. I never, ever dreamed that. I would not have wanted to have anything to do with an event where people who took the time to drive down there couldn't get inside the door. That was actually kind of disturbing to me, and I will never do something like that again where people can take the time, in some cases, to come down from Duluth or elsewhere and not even be able to get in because a fire marshal says so. That was unfortunate.
Right.
But it was a wonderful evening, I understand, for a lot of the people who came, and I'm happy for that, that they enjoyed each other's company. I'm of the belief that there were two things going on that night. One was the show out in the audience, which I didn't participate in and don't know much about. It just seems as though there was this whole world going on out there in the audience, this group of people that were talking to each other and meeting each other and enjoying each other's company and people checking out the wild variety of folk who showed. And then there was what I was doing on stage, and And after talking to people in the days following it, I realized I missed a good portion of that evening, of the portion that happened out in the audience. There was this real community feeling out there and a sense of a bunch of people who had, in one way, not a lot in common, in another way, something big in common. But you got the sense, hearing from people in the days following that, that something was going on out there in that crowd that was its own special thing. And I was happy for them for that, for
that's
the people
a good way
came.
To describe it. A lot of people with not much in common, but one.
Yeah.
But yet something in common, because there was people there who looked like your average Joe, and you had little old ladies. You had guys who looked like they came off some punk rock scene. A very varied group of people, but you couldn't have found a nicer bunch.
Decent,
more
decent
friendly,
folk. I was real happy to hear that. Yeah, I was real happy to hear. And I wish I could have gotten out of my body and gone out into the crowd and experienced that, because I had a very different experience of that evening. I enjoyed the people who came up and talked to me, but I was powerfully embarrassed by this long line that was coming up to me, because there were people who were waiting for hours, and there was nothing I could do about that. I can't rush the person in front of me. That's rude, and they've also waited. So I would let each person who talked to me till they were done talking to me. But at the same time, I was aware that there were people way, way back who had lives and probably homes they had to get to and jobs the next day, who maybe just wanted me to sign a CD, and there's nothing I could do to make their evening easier. They were going to have to wait, and that was an odd feeling, an uncomfortable feeling. I never was at ease that night. I was never real comfortable playing. I was nervous, and so for me, I had a very different experience of that night, but I loved getting the letters and calls and emails from people in the days that followed. I think it was successful because of that.
Leading up to that night, were you nervous?
Yeah. Oh, I dreaded it.
Okay. And I did get one email from, I think it was a younger kid, asking if there was still any chance that you would do another CD release party that youngsters could attend, or some of the people that didn't get in.
Yeah,
I said you had talked about it on the show before.
Well, first of all, it should be known that I'll never do another one where kids can't attend. That was a mistake on my part. I never even thought about that. I spent all my time trying to look for a decent space, a space that would have a good sound system and enough room, and that would have a bar, and I, without thinking about who would be excluded. And the one thing I realized about that O'Gara's night was all I had to do was do that Sunday afternoon, and I could have done it in the same place with the same sound system, same stage, and the kids could have come in. It was because I did it at night that it wasn't for kids. And so that was only something I learned afterwards. I didn't realize I was cutting out so many people. I had even forgotten that 18- and 19-year-olds wouldn't be able to come in. Not just kids, adults who weren't 21. So that was my mistake. And I won't do that again. I'll never do that again. I'll never exclude a group of people like that.
But would you still consider doing another one?
Yeah, I knocked around doing another CD. See, that one was a CD where I didn't play piano, which was an experiment. I wanted to experiment with not playing piano on it, even though that's my instrument. And I thought of doing another one where I just played piano as just a companion to it. Different songs, but where it was just me and piano. And just to have that comparison and that difference. And then using that as sort of the springboard to do another CD release party, only doing it right. And there's a better way to do it, so people aren't excluded and people don't come down from St. Cloud and find themselves unable to get in and turn around and drive home. Okay. So I'm thinking about it, but it's a lot of work, and it's so easy not to do it. It's always easier not to do it.
Right.
But I know that people want it, and I know that especially those who were excluded want it. So,
for Whistle Stop, did you write all the lyrics and put together the music?
Yeah, I wrote all the lyrics, and it says on the credit sheet on there, I think there were about 10 songs I did the music for exclusively, and then I think there might have been four songs where I shared music writing credit. Let's see, might have been three. But Jared Rush, the producer, helped me write the music on, I think, at least three songs. And then I wrote the music on the other ones, and I wrote the lyrics on all of them, sang on all of them, but only played on one, a musical instrument, and that was harmonica. Otherwise, and I really wanted to try this, otherwise I got musicians who were better than me, and I enjoyed being able to sing to that level of talent, or sing with that level of talent, to be able to hear people do with their instrument more than I could ever do with mine, be able to have that on my CD with my singing. It was a wonderful thing because I couldn't play my piano as well as those guys were playing their instruments, and yet I was going to get them on my CD. So it was sort of as though I was getting a better CD than I should have been able to get by using their talent. And I, when I'd listen back to it, I got such a high sometimes off listening to how good they were, and that I got to sing with them. It was as though, sort of like what the Blues Brothers must have felt like when all these great musicians agreed to play in their band, these incredible musicians. And there's John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd saying, we get to sing with these guys. It was sort of like that. So it was what the hell was the question?
I don't know, but Fred will like that Blues Brothers inference.
Oh, yeah. And remember, we're all on a mission from God.